Welcome to the Becoming Superhuman podcast,
where we interview extraordinary people to bring you the skills and strategies to overcome the impossible.
And now, here's your host, Jonathan Levy.
Before we get started, I just want to let you guys know that this episode is brought to you by my best-selling online course, Become a Speed Demon: Productivity Tricks to Have More Time. The course is the culmination of over a decade of my own experience and research into productivity theory, strategies, tips, and tricks. From how to prioritize and structure your life, to computer hacks and tips to automate your daily work, and even ways to shave time off the basic tasks we all do every day. The course is guaranteed to save you at least 3 hours a week or your money back. So for a 90% off coupon, check it out at jle.vi/productivity. That's http://jle.vi/productivity. Greetings, super friends, and welcome to the show. This week, you guys have been really awesome and sent in some requests, and we have brought on one of your most requested guests. Like many of the folks on this show, he has an extremely, extremely eclectic background. He started his career as a musician and a circus clown, and in the process of selling his CDs online, he somewhat accidentally started a company you may have heard of called CD Baby, and went on to become the largest seller of independent music on the web with over 100 million in sales and 200,000 plus artists. In 2008, he sold CD Baby and he began to focus on new ventures. And that's why we have him here on the podcast, because throughout that process, he had to learn and discover what it meant to build the type of life that he wanted to have. He's an expert in lifestyle design, although he does have some controversial thoughts on what that means. He's based in New Zealand, Singapore, and Belgium, of all places, and he shares my passion for self-improvement above all. He's a frequent speaker at the TED Conference. He's had over 10 million views of his talks, and he's published a staggering 34 books since 2011, including the number one bestseller, Anything You Want. You guys, in this interview, my goal was really to uncover and deconstruct the mentality of someone who's been not only successful in the classical sense, but also in the sense that matters most to me. He's a deeply happy, joyous person who's full of energy and is loving what he's doing every day, and he's designed exactly the type of life that he wants to live. We discuss a lot in the episode, from lifestyle design and entrepreneurship to the things that my guest most attributes to his tremendous success, and the values that guide his life and his decisions. Throughout the episode, he'll share a ton of really, really exciting and valuable wisdom, and you'll gain a unique and fascinating insight into the mind of someone leading a very untraditional and very extraordinary life. He offers a ton of practical tips and suggestions for making such change in our own lives, and for that reason, I know you're going to get a ton of value out of Mr. Derek Sivers. Derek, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, thank you.
So Derek, I have to tell you, I first heard about you through EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization, because, well, I was the president of the Silicon Valley chapter, but you are very highly regarded in the entrepreneurial community, particularly in the kind of self-starter and small business community.
Thank you.
Yeah, not too much to be said about that. Just thought I'd let you know. You know, I've wanted to meet you for quite some time. I think you did a lecture for EO at some point and I wasn't able to make it or something like that. So Derek, I think a lot of people probably know about you because of your work with CD Baby, but I'd love to have you chase us through a little bit about your bio. And since I also pivoted my career after selling my first company, I'd love to hear how you've handled that and how you've kind of moved on from that success to try new things and bigger and better things.
Sure. Okay. Big question. But so first, let me just kind of set the stage for your listeners, because some of the things I have to say at the beginning here will set the context for the rest, to help it make sense. So I think the first thing to understand is that I was just a musician, that I never aspired to be anything but a musician, right? Like I didn't want to be an entrepreneur. All I did is I just started this little music company as a hobby. I was just helping out a few friends. I didn't even mean to start a company. It was just a thing that I was helping my friends do But then friends of friends started calling saying, hey man, my friend said you could sell my CD. I'd say, sure, no problem. So it was really just a favor I was doing for people. But then the favors were taking up like 5 hours a day of my time. And that's when I started charging money for it, right? It was really just a favor I was doing for my community. But then it became huge beyond anything I had predicted or even wanted. I had 200,000 musician clients and $100 million in sales. And I had 85 employees. Whoa. And it was all on me. Like I was the sole owner. There were no investors. It was just me. I was the sole boss. I was the sole face of the company. It was a lot of pressure. Like there wasn't even like a nice hierarchy where people would report to other people. No, it was kind of like 85 people would vent their unhappiness to me. So it was also a lot of fame. Like National Public Radio did a profile on me and Esquire magazine had me in their best and brightest issue. And the fame was wonderful. It was a lot of praise and it was really nice, but it also came with a lot of pressure and expectations. You know, people see you in a magazine and they want things from you, or everybody wants to pick your brain, which is, you know, a very unappealing sounding thing.
Right.
So at the end, when I say the end, I mean like the last year or so that I was running CD Baby, it also got really nasty where the employees wanted to take the company in a different direction and I didn't want to. So there was a lot of bad blood and eventually I just sold it and walked away and I gave all the money from the sale into a charitable trust. Okay. So with that as like the stage that's set, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this feeling that every listener here either already knows or you will know someday. It's that feeling that your biggest success is already behind you, ooh, right? That you've peaked. And I think CD Baby was such a success that when I sold it, I felt like my gravestone would say, he made CD Baby and that's about it. Right? Like I was 38 years old and I was really just coming to terms with that feeling like, wow, I will never do anything that successful again. And I had to wrap my head around that. And so I think it was kind of close to the feeling that I hear a lot of people have where you have just like no motivation, no inspiration to do anything. Just kind of want to get through life and get it over with. I guess you could probably say I was depressed, but not really depressed. You know what I mean? Like I'm avoiding using that word because it wasn't really depressed, but just kind of, and just feeling like, all right, well,
that's done.
Yeah, that's done. My big achievements are done. So I guess I'll just hang out now.
Oh, I can relate.
Yeah. So it was also magnified by the fact that where the last couple of years of CD Baby were so bad and there was so much like personal attacks on me that I just wanted to like change my name and legally disappear just to avoid all responsibility. I actually read a few books on how to do this, like how to get off the grid, how to disappear, how to legally change your name. And I was seriously looked into it. I was seriously pursuing it. And I think this is also where having a lot of money can really mess with you because it can lead to absolute lethargy because there's no more extrinsic motivation anymore. Everything has to be 100% intrinsic motivation.
Sure.
When money just isn't an issue anymore. There's nothing you want to buy anymore. There's nowhere you haven't been that you want to go. Or if there's anything on your wish list, you just do it. You know, it's like, right. I've never been to Mongolia. Oh, there's a plane that leaves tonight. I guess I'll go, you know? Yeah, so you run out of bucket list stuff pretty fast. Okay, so that's where I was at. You ask about like, how did I make this transition after selling my company? So that's where I was at about the year after I sold my company.
Right.
But then two epiphanies happened in just a few hours. I was sitting on a plane, and I think I was actually reading the book called The 48 Laws of Power, or maybe it was his other one,
yeah.
Robert Greene, Art of Seduction, or something like that. I was reading one of Robert Greene's books, because I remember it was one of his historical tales about stepping up into your power and fame and stuff like that. And I realized that I kind of decided in that moment to just man up and step up to the responsibilities of fame because the benefits are worth it. That there are so many great things about being a little bit famous that I can man up and just deal with the occasional downsides, right? Because I have this belief that being at least somewhat famous is one of the most useful things you can do for the world because the opposite of doing that is hiding, you know, where you just like lay low and don't do anything very public. I think it's extremely useful to others when you're out there and doing things publicly, right? So I just decided, you know, I'm more useful to the world when I'm not hiding. So this whole like change my name and disappear thing, like, no, I'm just going to man up. All right, I'm a little bit famous. I'm just going to step into it and own it. And in fact, that like led immediately to my second epiphany is that almost immediately after deciding this, I had a bigger vision of who I could be if I decided to step into this. This is back before TEDx was invented, right? So right. TED was just this like once a year, big giant conference. And being a TED speaker felt like winning a Pulitzer Prize or something.
Right.
So I decided that I wanted to do that. I wanted to speak at TED and I wanted to be surrounded with and accepted by this new community of intellectuals. I wanted to be known as a writer and a speaker and a thinker kind of guy, which for me at the time, right, I was only in music at that time, right? So this was a big aspirational dream of mine to do something that was beyond music. And suddenly, like, this was inspiring. This was kind of like the depression buster, right? This was like the first thing in a year that made me kind of jump out of my seat and get excited and want to do something. And so that's when I learned that goals should only be judged by their ability to change your actions in the present, right? Like if a goal doesn't improve your present actions, it's not a good goal. And so here I was kind of witnessing that just this idea of being a TED speaker was like getting me so charged up. And so I started spending like 4 to 6 hours a day just exploring thoughts and finding ways to present them in really short, succinct ways on my blog. And I would spend like 6 hours a day just like editing one little 6-paragraph post, right? Like chopping down every word to make sure it couldn't be misunderstood and trying to make every sentence piercing and powerful. And then I applied to TED and I got accepted to speak not just once, but at 3 big main stage TED conferences in a row.
Incredible.
So finally, to answer your question, I think the sweetest reward came when my TED Talks got really popular. And the most common question I would get from all these new people I was meeting was like, so what did you do before TED? And then I realized like, wow, people don't know me from CD Baby anymore. Like I actually did it. That career pivot thing that you hear about, it was so reassuring to know it can be done. And it's so much more exciting.
Oh, so. Wow. Your journey so resonated with me because I felt the same way. And, you know, I went about it with the business school route and then the, oh my God, what am I going to do now route? But I'm so glad that I'm not the only one who felt this after kind of a windfall success of like, okay, well, you know, peaked at this age.
Yeah.
Incredible. So I have to admit, I actually learned about your TED Talks on how to start a movement in business school. And you should know that a lot of professors in organizational behavior actually play this in one of the first lectures. So I think that's absolutely incredible. And it was a huge pivot, speaking of pivots, for me and my leadership skills. So I have to ask, since you're a self-described introvert, where did you gain such spot-on insights about leadership? I mean, the TED Talk is absolutely brilliant.
Thanks. Well, I hate to break it to you, but I don't know much about leadership. I really only know about 3 minutes worth of stuff. And I really, you know, compressed everything I know into this 3-minute talk called Leadership Lessons Learned from a Dancing Guy, the First Follower. And honestly, man, that's about all I have to say about it. That I was really just echoing what I had learned from Seth Godin's book called Tribes and Malcolm Gladwell's book called The Tipping Point. And I read those two books, and shortly after I saw this video of a guy dancing at a music festival and how everybody started joining in. And the first time I watched it, I just laughed. And the second time, you know, that was actually kind of a good metaphor about leadership and everything I've learned about how to make a movement. So I just shared some of my insights on my blog. It was just one of those things, like where I said that once I decided I had this goal, I was spending 6 hours a day just sitting there thinking and trying to communicate ideas in short, punchy ways. And yeah, that's about all I have to say on the subject. But because I did that TED talk, it makes it look like I'm an expert on something. But I, you know, I'm really not an expert on the subject. But I've been invited to dozens of big corporations to speak about leadership. And I got a lot of book offers from publishers to develop this first follower leadership idea. But I just politely declined them all. I said, no, thank you. I'm sorry. That's just not really an interest of mine.
Fair enough. I do want to point out, though, your incredible humility, because on the one hand, you know, you don't know a lot about leadership and building a tribe besides what you've read. On the other hand, your bio story was, yeah, I had a couple friends. And then before I knew it, there were 200,000 artists. I just want to point out to our audience how incredibly humble you are about all of this.
Well, you know, we never have any perspective on ourselves, do we?
That is so true. So changing gears then from the leadership, your book subtitles 40 Lessons for a New Kind of Entrepreneur. And I joke with my friends that I'm the anti-startup entrepreneur and that, you know, I'm completely over traditional entrepreneurial culture. Well, traditional, you know, the culture of the last 15 years. So I'm interested what your take is on what this new kind of entrepreneur is and what's new about him or her.
Well, to be fair, Seth Godin chose that title. So like I just said, I don't think any of us really have much perspective on our own story, right? I mean, the book is called Anything You Want. And again, Seth Godin chose that title too. It's just a tiny book that you can read in about an hour that has 40 little tiny stories about the lessons learned from starting, building, and selling my company. So it's meant to just be a short little punchy thing with, it's not telling my story. It's more just like, in the arc of doing what I did, here are the most important 40 things I learned that I think you should know.
Sure.
So that said, so I can't see my own story without much perspective, but what I've heard from other people that they like about it is mostly this idea that by being generous, by forgetting yourself and your own needs, by doing what's really best for your customers in like a really shockingly generous and friendly way, you can actually succeed in business better than those who are taking this MBA analytical maximum profit approach.
Sure.
So to me, it all feels like common sense, right? Just be nice, be generous, be considerate, make people really happy, and they'll be happy to open up their wallets and pay you, right? It's kind of like that old 1930s book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Wow, have you read that?
My favorite book of all time, actually.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think for anybody listening who hasn't read it yet, you should. Kicking it old school in the 1930s. I think the title is really unfortunate because it makes it sound like it's a slimy book about how to trick people into liking you. But actually, I think it should be called How to Be Considerate. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's the most amazing book about looking at everything from the other person's point of view. And the punchline of the book is that the way to win friends and influence people is to be sincerely interested in others and always connect with them around their own interests, exactly, not yours. So my little book is about that approach to business. So it sounds simple, but people tell me that it's very counterintuitive, especially if you've been immersed in shitty business practices your whole life.
Right.
And you know, we get acclimated to the sad state of affairs at most places. Then people tell me that my little book is a breath of fresh air. But to me, it just seems like common sense, you know?
I love that. It also reminds me a little bit of Tony Hsieh's book, the guy from Zappos,
yeah,
Delivering Happiness, and just the way that you said, overwhelm your customers with, and I think that's also a metaphor for life, overwhelm anyone who you're providing value to, whether it's friendship or business, with just kindness and over-deliver, and you get such incredible benefits from it, as do they, of course.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
So what are the other 30 plus books about?
Well, I mean, I published 33 books about 16 countries in Asia for 2 years in a row, 2013 and 14.
Wow.
I published 16 books a year about 16 countries in Asia. And then at the end, I did one big wrap up book called like Asia 2014. So I just did that when I moved to Singapore because it was my way of getting to know my new neighborhood.
I love it. Where did you live in Singapore?
Right in Marina Bay. Do you know it?
I do. I lived right by the INSEAD campus.
So
Cheaper part of town, if you will. But yeah.
Oh, but no, a nicer part of town. I lived right next to Marina Bay Sands on the 51st floor. Out of my window, I could see Indonesia and Malaysia and Singapore, of course. But yeah, it was a nice idea. Like when I was apartment hunting, you know, you look at a bunch of places, then suddenly they show me this apartment on the 51st floor. I'm like, oh my God, I'll take it. But of course, my first night living there, I realized that Singapore does all of its big, noisy, celebratory activities right there in the marina outside my window. So every night at 7, 9, and 11 was a big, giant laser light and sound show that I listened to three times a night for 2 years. So the three times three, almost 2,000 times I had to listen to that piece of music.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so yeah, I wish I could have lived by INSEAD. Anyway, yeah.
Let me ask you this, Derek. We talked about the new kind of entrepreneur. Would you consider yourself to be a lifestyle entrepreneur?
Maybe, but I think that a focus on lifestyle can be dangerous. I think it's kind of a recipe for misery. lifestyle is such a me focus, right? It's like focusing on making all of your dreams come true, making your immediate gratification the most important thing. But it seems to assume that if you just make yourself very happy by being in the perfect climate with the perfect laptop and the perfect phone and the perfect camera and the perfect schedule surrounded by perfect people doing perfect hobbies, if you make your life exactly what you want, that then you'll be happy. But I think that ultimately it's not very useful to others. And the way to be rewarded in this world and have a wonderful, rewarding life is to be very useful to others, right? So you can go ahead and pursue a lifestyle that you love, but you have to understand that it's a shallow comfort, that it doesn't pay. And the deeper rewards really come from the things that you do for others.
Totally. I give a lecture on failure and entrepreneurship. And one of the things that I always say is that the greatest failure someone shouldn't accept is the failure to build a life full of things and full of work that you really love. I think the term lifestyle entrepreneur gets wrapped up with kind of, I run this company that I hate. We sell products that I don't use and I make a ton of money and that's it. And I don't have to work. But I think there's a route to take it where you have this need in your life and in your lifestyle for serving others. And how are you going to kind of fill that role and fill that need?
Well, you know what I might be confusing it with too? I just a month or so ago went to a conference in Berlin that was called like the Digital Nomad Conference.
Oh, wow.
And it felt that everybody there was just trying to do this Tim Ferriss style lifestyle design. Like, I just want to get my lifestyle, man. I want to live in Bali. I want to be in a hammock. I want to have a muse business that runs without me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just feel that everybody's pursuing this dream lifestyle that ultimately, like when I listen to them describing this, they're just talking about themselves the whole time. It's not about how they can be valuable to others. It's just like, I want this and I want that. And I want a hammock in Bali and I want this and I want that. And I think, yeah, okay, your biggest rewards in life come from when you're being most valuable to others.
I love it.
You can, yeah, pursue the lifestyle you want, of course. I'm not saying be a martyr. Yeah, if you know that there's something that makes you really happy, go for it. But don't overvalue it and think that this is what it's all about.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I'm glad you segued into lifestyle design because I know you are a major inspiration for a ton of people in that, you know, you've moved all over the world. You've lived in three countries. As you said, you've ticked off almost everything on your bucket list. So I am interested to hear a little bit about your life philosophy and how you pick the different elements that you integrate into your life.
That's a big question. I think that most of the unusual things I do come from some core fundamental idea, right? Like I tend to read a lot of books and I find one little core idea in there and I extrapolate that into like how I can apply it to my life, right? Okay, so one example is this idea that our minds only grow when they're surprised, right? So when something is not exactly as you expected, that's when you learn new patterns or new logic or learn a new approach to things. Mm-hmm. It's if you're not surprised, you're not learning. So when I heard that idea, I was 37 and I was newly free. I think I was about to sell CD Baby. And so I decided that a way to accelerate that process of constant surprise and keeping an open mind on a daily basis, or at least to, you know, try to be in an environment where surprise could happen often, is to live in a new country.
Yep.
I'm not saying that's the answer, that is the way that everybody must do, but that's one way. And it's a way that fit my life at that time where I wasn't tied down to anything. So I thought that maybe doing this would help me avoid some habitual approaches to life and avoid getting stuck into a rut that you often see people do. This is kind of an age thing. People have this shared cultural agreement that when you were a child and when you're a teen, and maybe even when you're in your 20s, you're constantly learning and growing and reinventing yourself. And then people get into their 30s and they kind of just do this thing where they say, yeah, this is who I am. You know?
Yep.
This is where I live. This is my favorite sports team. This is my favorite breakfast. This is the kind of music I like. And they kind of have this feeling of being done, right? And so I wanted to avoid that. In fact, man, that's why I left Santa Monica. I was living in Santa Monica at the time and I was so happy. I loved Santa Monica. I loved living there so much that I made myself leave because I had the feeling that if I didn't leave, I would just kind of get stuck there. It was almost a retirement mindset. Just be like, yep, this is my favorite place. This is where I am. I'm done. End of the rainbow. So yeah, I made myself move to a place that was uncomfortable. I mean, it's not like Singapore is so uncomfortable, but it was out of my comfort zone. And I want to keep forcing myself to do that for life, avoiding my comfort zones.
I love it. I really love it. Although, yeah, you're right. Singapore is often called Disneyland with a death penalty.
Singapore is a deeper place than it appears to be.
Totally.
In fact, if we want to get on a long rant about Singapore, I mean, in a good way. Like, I'm rah-rah Singapore, man. I love Singapore with all my head. It's one of my favorite places in the world. And I think that when people visit on the surface, they just see that it's squeaky clean. But if they don't understand the reason why it's squeaky clean, that actually being squeaky clean was like a survival strategy for a country in the 60s that thought they wouldn't survive, that they were just going to get invaded by their many neighbors that would love to invade them, that being a corporate headquarters for Asia was their survival strategy.
Exactly.
Actually, they have a lot in common with Israel.
I was just going to say, being Israeli and arriving there on a flight from Israel, I heard the whole story from every taxi driver, every uncle, as they say.
Yeah.
So really, really interesting there as well.
So you mentioned like, how do I choose what I'm doing? So I guess I started to say that I really like to read books about psychology or even philosophy, which I think is just kind of like psychology turned into directives or suggestions, right? But then when an idea resonates with me, I really try to apply it to my life. Like the example I gave of trying to, you know, living around the world. It's just one little idea. But I think that I've always been extremely long-term future focused, right? Like doing things that don't necessarily make me happy short-term, but that I think are ultimately better for me long-term, right? Like the Singapore example. Right. I could have just stayed in Santa Monica and just been happy right now and in the present moment, the ultimate comfort. But I felt that I would have paid a longer-term price by being more of a narrow person, like having more narrow experiences in life. So yeah, pushing yourself out of your comfort zone is short-term discomfort, but with the reward, the longer-term reward of having a greater range of things that you understand and can accept and work with or feel comfortable in, you know, multiple places that feel like home, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, when I sold CD Baby, I felt like the obvious trajectory I could have taken was just move to Silicon Valley and be a tech investor or a serial entrepreneur. And I think that those things might have led to more immediate happiness, more money or more praise or more fame. But I wanted that deeper challenge of succeeding at something that was more difficult with those longer term rewards.
I see. I like that approach a lot. Another thing I really loved on your website, Derek, is you said that your main act of public service is answering emails from strangers. So people should feel free to email you. I love that for a lot of reasons. One, because you put it out there as a public declaration. But also, you know, I think of the idea that I'd rather contribute to something unique to me in terms of public service, as opposed to, say, cleaning up trash on the side of the road that, you know, anyone can do. And you want to give your unique value. So I'm dying to know what kind of emails you're getting and what's the unique way in which you're able to address those emails.
Oh, I'm like a free shrink, life coach or business mentor. I think I spend like 10 to 15 hours a week just answering people's questions. I enjoy it for the most part. And whenever I'm not in the mood for it, I don't do it. I don't answer my email every single day. I do it every 2 or 3 days. But I don't get deeply involved. Like I don't become somebody's official mentor and get deeply involved with their company. I'm not on any board of directors or anything. I generally just answer questions. So I think a lot of people have career questions or lifestyle questions, or sometimes even like out of the blue, I'll just get an email from somebody in India saying that he's very frustrated with his sister right now and what should he do about it? I'm like, all right. And I try to just conjure up what wisdom I've learned from life and books and such. So maybe I'm just kind of in training to be a wise old man.
I love that. Okay, well, I'll segue into that. I'm sure you don't want to give too much about people's kind of private problems on a podcast. So we'll segue from that. But let me talk about another one of your TED Talks, which is where you said something that actually really surprised me, which is that we should keep our goals to ourselves. And generally, I actually try and share my goals a lot, whether it's with friends or on social media or even on the podcast. I'll talk about projects that I'm hoping to release by December. I'm doing this. And I use it as accountability and I use it to apply a little bit of social pressure. Why is it that you feel this doesn't work, out of curiosity?
Okay, so again, I'm not an expert in this. In fact, just to give a little context, so when TED is about to have a conference and they do a little bit of open call for speakers for the short talks, for all of those 20-minute talks, they go find those speakers. But for those little 3-minute talks, it's kind of open call. So I was putting in my bid to do another 3-minute talk, and I pitched 3 ideas at them. One was a talk that I really wanted to do that I felt was going to be great. The second one was like an idea that was kind of the backup plan. I felt it would be good. And then I thought, well, I really want to do a talk no matter what. So let me give them a third option, which is this Newsweek article I just read today that says that announcing your plans makes them less likely to happen. Like, I literally just read it like an hour before and thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I just wrote that down as like a third option. I could talk about that. And then that's the one they chose.
Wow.
So suddenly I'm giving a TED talk about something I'd learned about that day. So I contacted the guy that did all of this original research. And I guess you have to understand that the TED is just a bit of entertainment, right? Those aren't really university courses. It's just like a little bit of intellectual snacking. So I was actually given 2.5 minutes to do my talk. So I had to leave out some nuance. But if you go to my original webpage for it, which is sivers.org/zipit, Z-I-P-I-T, that's where you'll find the original article that has links to the original research. So the deal is this, that when you announce some identity goal, and the guy that did the original research asked me to emphasize the fact that it's for identity goals. That's something where just by announcing it, you're now seen as more noble or daring or brave or athletic or admirable. Ah. That when people give you social praise for this announcement, well, then you've already felt a lot of the pleasure. So now you're less motivated to do the hard work necessary to make the goal happen. If you say, like, I'm going to run a marathon, or I'm going to do an Ironman competition, or I'm going to bike around the world. Well, now your friends say, wow, Jonathan, man, I could never do that. Whoa, an Ironman, you must be really dedicated. Oh man, you are hardworking, man. I really admire you. So now you've already felt this social praise, right? So you're less motivated to do the hard work. But here's the point that was lost in the 2.5 minute TED talk, is that this doesn't apply to other goals. So if you're talking about, say, like starting a new company, well, then it helps to tell as many people as possible to expand your resources and your input and get lots of feedback and lots of new ideas. Then, yeah, of course, you should tell those kind of goals to as many people as possible. So this discouragement or premature satisfaction only comes from announcing identity goals.
I love it. Okay, so it's about that kind of that hit of dopamine or serotonin that kind of says, I've already made it half the way there.
Yeah, you're already envisioning achieving it. Kind of like, I mean, I was a musician for 20 years, or you could say I still am. But in music and athletics, I think we talk about how you can close your eyes and picture a perfect performance of something. And it's actually kind of like you were practicing it, right? Like just imagining it sends those little tiny signals into your neurons and whatnot that has almost the same effect as actually physically practicing something. So I think it's the same thing. Like when you vividly imagine yourself achieving this goal or doing the Ironman or a marathon or speaking fluent Mandarin or whatever it may be, you're already getting the pleasure in advance of actually achieving it. And therefore it's like, I've already felt the pleasure. So you're not quite as motivated to do the hard work necessary.
Right. So I suppose I should avoid the temptation to ask you what some of your goals are.
Oh, do I have any?
Maybe I can ask, what are the values that are driving your goals? You talked about service to others. I mean, I guess unless you want to share a couple broader goals, what are the values that help you drive what goals you'll set for yourself?
Actually, you just named it. I do often find that when I get a little paralyzed over wondering what to do next, if I just ask myself this question of, well, what's most useful to other people? Or how can I be of the most value to others? That usually answers it. Of course, there are things that I'm interested in doing that aren't directly useful to others. You know, I do want to learn Mandarin. I think it's fascinating. I love the Chinese writing system, and I just think the language is so interesting. So I want to learn that. But, you know, ultimately, is it the most valuable use of my time? No. But it's a bit of a compromise. This is something I want to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas, for example, spending the 10 or 15 hours a week answering every single email that comes in, that's being very directly useful to the world. And spending some time building some of the new web app ideas I have, some of the new company ideas that I think might be useful to others. Yeah, sometimes it's not always the most fun thing I could be doing to spend my time on that, but I do it because it's ultimately most useful to others. So yeah, it's a good way of unparalyzing yourself by using that standard.
Definitely. I'm a big advocate of, as in your company, you have core values that help employees make decisions. I, in my personal life, have 10 core values that I put above all. And so when I'm faced with a difficult decision in my personal or professional life, it's very easy to look on those values and say, well, my top value is to be authentic and trustworthy and genuine with people. So I'm not going to take the easy route and I'm going to tell this person exactly how I feel.
I love it. Those little rules of thumb, man, those little heuristics, whether it's a list of 10 values or even those simple, those little morals, whether it's 10 commandments or whatever people may have that guide them, Aesop's fables. Yep. They make these little things that are so easy to remember. I don't know, for me, the one I got when I was a teenager, I don't know if I heard it from someone or if I just came up with it myself, but it was whatever scares you, go do it.
Oh yeah.
And I've been living with that almost daily since I was a teenager, that just when in doubt, when faced with any situation, whatever scares you, go do it. Kind of like the Santa Monica idea I said earlier, where staying in Santa Monica was the comfort choice. And I think Abraham Maslow, psychologist, said something about every day we're presented 100 times a day with a choice between safety and risk. And he said, make the growth choice 100 times a day. Something like that. And I love that. Even those tiny little choices you make in the day, like what would be the choice that would help me grow as a person? And what would be the choice that would be me kind of staying in my safety zone?
Oh, I love that. I'm just now kind of coping with this and dealing with it. I had a friend, actually Dr. Anthony Metivier, who's a colleague of mine, tell me that same thing where I'd say, you know, I really want to try this, but I'm terrified of it. And I won't say what, but he goes, that's the exact reason why you have to do it. So
yep.
In the process of figuring out how I'm going to do this.
And it can be tiny things, man. There would just be sometimes I'd see some like gorgeous girl and I'd be like, oh my God, she's so out of my league. I'm terrified. I'm like, whatever scares you, go do it. Here I go.
Exactly. I love that. So I realized, Derek, I keep asking about everything I found on your site almost verbatim, but I think that's a testament to how well you write and how concisely you make points. So I really, really want to ask you, you describe yourself as anti-drama, and that really resonates with me. So tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. I think I say that on the homepage of my site because it's a link to my favorite fable. Should I tell it? I guess it only takes a minute.
Yeah, sure.
All right. It's pretty widely known. So I think it's been in some movies and some other people have quoted it in their books. But it goes like this. It's that a man and his son have a horse and they only have one horse. And one day their only horse runs away and all of their neighbors come by and say, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. You must be so upset. And the man just shrugged and said, well, we'll see. And about a week later, that only horse came back and it had 20 other horses in tow. And the man and his son gathered all of these horses into the corral and suddenly they had 21 horses and they were like the richest people in their village. And all the neighbors came by and said, oh my gosh, you must be so happy. What wonderful news. You must be ecstatic. And the man just shrugged and he said, well, we'll see. And then because of these 21 wild horses, one day one of the wild horses kicked his son in the legs, breaking both of his legs. And suddenly the old man's only son was laid up in bed. Old man had to do everything himself. And the neighbors came by and said, oh, you must be so upset. I'm so sorry. The man just said, we'll see. And then shortly after, the country went to war and every able-bodied young man was sent off to war and they were all killed in a horrible battle. But the man's son was spared because his legs were broken. And the neighbors came by and said, oh, you must be so thankful. The man just said, we'll see.
Yep.
And that's it. I love that story.
I love
because
it.
Something I think is a core thing about myself is that I've always had a very long-term focus, right? Like even when I was, I don't know, like 17 years old, some of my friends were starting to get tattoos and like, man, you got to get a tattoo. And I said, you know, I think when I'm 90, I won't want that tattoo. And they just looked at me weird. Like when you're 90, dude, who cares about when you're 90, man? I want this tattoo now. I think it's cool. The yin yang, man. And I'm like, no, I think when I'm old, that's not going to look good. So I don't know. For some reason, I've always been in service of my future self, right? So I think that if you looked back at whatever you were worried about 5 years ago, right? Like if you were to go read your old diaries from 5 years ago, talking about everything that was upsetting you then, you'll bet you'd find out that those problems have probably just sorted themselves out by now and everything is fine, right? So things smooth themselves out with time. So I feel like, why get so upset about these short-term things? If your eyes are on the horizon, right? It's like those little rocks in the road don't bother you. So I think it's also just that I really love tranquility and silence. I find my own thoughts very entertaining. I don't need to spice up my life with drama for entertainment, you know?
I love that. And I have to admit, that's one of my favorite stories of all time. Although I hadn't heard that version, but I got the version that I know from Eckhart Tolle's work, which is also one of the most impactful books I've ever read.
Cool.
Yeah. So how then, you know, if you're focused on the horizon and on the long term, how are you structuring your days?
I don't.
I love it.
I really don't. I tend to just dive into one thing at a time and get really, really into one thing at a time until I'm feeling done with it. And then I'll just dive into the next thing. And I guess these cycles go sometimes for weeks. Sometimes it's a short-term thing. Something I'm programming will just take a few weeks to finish, and then I'll go work on my book for a while. Or sometimes it takes months or even a couple years to just dive into one thing until I feel that it's done. And then I'll just go do the next thing. So my friend Tynan wrote this book. I was about to say it's called Becoming Superhuman, but no, that's something else. What is it called? I think it's called Superhuman by Habit. Mm. Does that sound right? Tynan.com, T-Y-N-A-N.com is his site. And yeah, I think it might be Superhuman by Habit. Anyway, yeah, it's a great book about how to design a life by making habits and living by your habits, like deciding what your values are, what's important to you, and making habits for yourself to make sure that you do everything that's important to you. And I read the book, and it's a wonderful argument in favor of this, but I tend to just dive into one thing at a time. So no, I have no routine. Sometimes I bounce out of bed at 3:30 in the morning, excited to dive back into whatever I was doing at midnight when I fell asleep. And other mornings I sleep until 7, hang out with my kids all day.
Awesome. And then you just work on whatever you feel inspired to work on in that day?
Yeah. It's nice not having a boss.
Yeah. No kidding. No kidding. So let me ask this then. Why don't we transition into a bit of a lightning round? Because I have a ton of short form questions that I would love
sure.
to ask you.
All right.
So the first one is, when you think of the word successful, who's the first person who comes to mind?
It's not a person. I think discipline. For some reason, the word discipline comes to mind first. Like, I think I really admire discipline. I really admire those that don't lose control. So yeah, I don't have a single person that personifies that. I think it's a whole collection of people I really admire are the ones that live with discipline.
Love it. That's an awesome approach. We talked about a couple books, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, but what are the books that have most impacted your life?
Well, instead of naming one or two, I started this thing on my site about 8 years ago where I started taking detailed notes on every book I've read while reading it. I would underline my favorite sentences or circle my favorite paragraphs, then I would type them all into a text file so that I could review it and really internalize it. Like, I wanted to remember, really internalized, ingest everything I had learned and make it a part of myself.
I do the same thing.
So I started sharing those notes a few years ago and putting them just out for free on my site. So if you go to sivers.org/book, sivers.org/book, you'll see over 220 books I've read with the detailed notes on each one. And I've sorted them with my top recommendations at the top. So that was kind of the answer to your question, like which books had the biggest impact on me. I think the reason I don't think it would be fair to just name one or two is because I've noticed that it's a bit of a timing thing, right? Like, one of the biggest influences on me was Tony Robbins' book, Awaken the Giant Within. And I think it's just because I read it at the right time when I was 19 years old, and that's what I needed to hear then. But when I reread it again now, I kind of go like, same old, same old. Mm-hmm. And say, for example, I asked Tim Ferriss that question once, and he said that, I think it was the book that he said was that kind of life changer for him. I think it was Maximum Achievement by Brian Tracy or something like that. But so I went, oh, wow. So Tim said that like that was the biggest impact on him. I have to go read this book. And I read it, and it was just like, same old self-help crap, you know?
Right.
So, but on the other hand, I realized, yeah, if I would have read that book first before Awaken the Giant Within, then yeah, that probably would have had a big impact on me. So instead of me telling your listeners just one or two books that impacted me long ago, I think, go to sivers.org/book and look at a list of the ones that I think are the best of the best with my favorite ones up top,
yeah,
and see which one resonates with you right now.
There are a lot of really, really good ones on here. I'm actually checking them out, but I have to admit a lot of them I've actually never heard of.
So cool.
I'm
good.
Going to dig through this myself, actually. Awesome. All right. So next lightning round question. What's the most impactful $100 you've spent recently?
It's got to be books.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry to sound like a broken record, but yeah, I think books are such a great value. One of my best friends is just a real extrovert. She just loves to be around lots of people all the time. And she spends like $15,000 to go to these masterclass seminars, and she'll fly off to Vegas, and there'll be 1,000 other attendees in this big room, and they're all standing on chairs and pumping their fists in the air and yelling affirmations. And the person on stage, they're sharing even less than they put into their $15 book. But now they're charging $15,000 to attend and hear them say it on stage, right? So I'm so thankful that I learn best from books. Because it's just, God, you know, 15 bucks to buy a book. And you think of like how much that 15 little books did for you. So yeah, I think my books.
I love it. People often ask me what the most important turning point in my life was. And I have to say it was when I learned how to hack my memory and speed read. Which is the reason that I teach it now, is it was probably the most impactful thing I've ever learned.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. So what's one practical piece of homework? We love to assign homework on the show. So what's one practical piece of homework that you'd like our audience to do this week, whether it's read a book, practice a thought exercise, or something like that?
Yeah. Sorry. I'm just going to be boring. I'd say, yeah, read a book from my list and then email me afterwards.
Ooh, that is a really, really good one. I love it. All right. And can we put your email on the show notes?
Yeah. Let's tell her right now.
All right. All right.
Derek, D-E-R-E-K at Sivers, SIVERS.org.
Awesome. So read one book. Once you've done that, email Derek. Tell him what you thought.
Yeah.
Derek, if people take away one message from this podcast, what would you like it to be?
Email me and introduce yourself, because I think that anyone that listens to your show is my kind of person.
Awesome.
That's why I was psyched to be on it. Yeah, I don't need the fame, and I'm not doing this to sell books or anything, obviously. I wasn't here pitching anything. So I just, I love what you're doing, and people that are a fan of your show are my kind of people. So yeah, if you made it all the way to the end of this, send me an email.
Thank you. So let me ask then, because we didn't get a chance to talk too much about what you're working on. What's next for you?
Dinner.
No, I mean career-wise.
dinner. Yeah, I'm going to have dinner after this.
Rock on.
Let's see. Well, actually, I just posted something on my site that I think is, it's a vague idea now, but it, you know, just, I had a kid a few years ago, and
congrats.
I was thinking about that. I'm always a bit of a pessimist in that stoic kind of way, stoicism kind of way of preparing for the worst. And so I often think of the fact that it's likely that I'll die before he's very old. So I think I really need to try to share everything I've learned. And so I look at all these 220 books that I've read in the last few years and all of my detailed notes on them. And I've noticed that a lot of books talk around a subject, or they share a lot of findings, but very few of them, or almost never, do they just tell you what to do and say, do this. But yet I've noticed that when I tell a lot of my friends about these amazing books I've read, a lot of my friends are not book readers. And even if they're smart people, like I'll say, oh my God, you got to read this book. And they'll say, nah, dude, come on. You know me. I'm never going to read that book. Why don't you just tell me what it says I should do?
Right.
And I noticed that that was my friend's most common question. It's like, so what should I do? Tell me what to do. What does the book say I should do? Because we're not going to really sit around and talk around the issues. It's just, tell me how this will change my life. And it made me think about something like the Ten Commandments. I guess I brought that up earlier, because it wasn't like there were stone tablets discussing issues. Or like, let's talk around these issues. It was like, no, we're just going to tell you what to do. Do these 10 things, or don't do these 6 things and do these 4 things. Mm-hmm. And it can be a really succinct way to communicate a philosophy. Kind of like, it made me think of the metaphor of seeds. You know, when you have little dandelion seeds that blow in the wind, it's because they have their little seed inside of them, right? So I think that the philosophy of something can be a little seed inside a simple directive. Like if you just tell somebody, let's say, whatever scares you, go do it, right? That's just a tiny commandment. But inside that is a bigger philosophy. But if you just do the action, you were living the philosophy. So yeah, I've been thinking about ways to turn this into something. I don't know if it's, I'm not saying that this will be a product or even a book, but just something I'm interested in. So if you go to my site and you look at my blog, one of the newest blog posts right now is at sivers.org/2D, letter O. So it's to do, but spelled out as 2DO. That's where you'll see the new post where I'm kind of talking around this issue. And anybody that's interested in doing this, or if you also have some ideas on this, like how to turn all of this wisdom into specific directives, telling people what to do. Yeah, that's something I'm thinking of doing now.
I really, really love that. And it's something I actually encourage my students to do. I'm in the process of reworking my course on accelerated learning. And like you said, you know, even if you have all these mnemonic techniques, I saw that you've also read, I've been perusing your book list. So I saw you've also read Moonwalking with Einstein's. And you know a lot about, you know, how you can store memories long-term.
Yeah.
But even with that said, even if you have these incredible techniques, you need to review, you need spaced repetition.
Yep.
So I encourage my students to summarize books and then go over them, you know, once a month, go over the last few books you've read. And it would be really interesting.
I'm so glad you brought this up. I just realized, your listeners are the people that know this the best. So my very first idea with like these, you know, 220 book notes, and each one is, you know, you'll see pages and pages of notes on that book. My very first thought was like, how do I put this into spaced repetition? Right? Like, how can I memorize what I've learned from these books with spaced repetition? And honestly, I haven't figured out the answer yet. I actually played with some things. I did I think you call it the closure technique, where you omit certain words. But even then I was like, well, it's not like this sentence I want to memorize. I'm not memorizing poetry. I want to memorize this concept, this idea, so that it just becomes as internalized as, you know, one of those ones I said earlier, whatever scares you, go do it. Or your list of the 10 principles. Was it 10 or 20 that you said you had?
I have 10 core values.
10 to core values. I would love for a lot of the things I've learned in these books to be that tip of my tongue, tip of my mind kind of thing. So they just are called up really frequently, just whenever a life situation hits. But I'm not sure how to use spaced repetition for something like that. I'm such a fan of Anki for so many other things.
Yeah,
and I've used it even for learning like programming languages. If you go to sivers.org/SRS, you'll see my story about how to use spaced repetition to learn a programming language. And it's how I kind of crash coursed myself in JavaScript really fast. And
that's really awesome.
Memorized it instead of having to look up everything I was doing. And yeah, so I'm a huge fan of spaced repetition, but how to do that for these book notes, I'm not sure yet.
I'll tell you what I would do, and then I'm going to send you a copy of my book as well. What I would do is I would have the title of the book. I'd probably sketch out, because it's hard to find images for it, but I'm all about visual memory. I saw that you also read my buddy Anthony Mativier's book. So, you know, this whole visualization thing that he and I both teach. And what I would do is I'd have a book, and then I'd have a sketch for each core concept. And I would force myself to remember what that sketch essentially is invoking. So one of your books was the China study, which studies not just China, but also other countries. So I might picture a Chinese emperor, sketch out a Chinese emperor. He might have 10 different arms if there were 10 different countries. Each arm would be holding either a flag, if the flag is readily recognizable, or some other, a guy named Stan Lee packing a suitcase, for example. And then I would remember that one of the core concepts is that he compared the diets of 10 different countries against China, right? And I mean, I don't know, that's probably not a core concept. I haven't read the book, to be honest with you, but it's one of the examples, one of the visualizations I'm giving in my upcoming TEDx talk. So
cool. As soon as you started describing this, I picture an emperor. I just noticed that like my eyes closed as soon as you started saying this. I was like vividly picturing everything you were saying. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. So Derek, I know we're running long. I really do appreciate your time. I know it's your MO, but you did not have to accept our interview. So I appreciate that you did. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly learned a lot.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Love what you're doing.
Awesome. So I'd love to pick your brain at some point. Maybe I'll be one of the people to send you an email to pick your brain about, giving a TED Talk tips and transitioning from the TEDx to the TED, which is going to be my next goal, hopefully.
Cool. I can just tell you in a sentence or two, my main advice for anybody listening that's going to be giving a TED Talk is just focus on what's surprising.
Mm.
Write out everything you want to say and then scribble out everything that you think will not be a surprise, and just focus on what's surprising. And if they give you 18 minutes to do the talk, practice doing a 12-minute talk. Like, always err on the side of too short. The ones I can tell you from attending many TED conferences that talks that people often walk away going like, damn, that was powerful, are often the ones that were shorter than they needed to be because they just told you surprising stuff. Like people go to TED to learn something, right? And it's an idea. You're not learning unless you're surprised. So just focus on what's surprising and just chop out the rest.
I love it. Awesome. So I'm going to go hack out about 20% of my TED talk. Derek, I really appreciate it. Again, thank you so much. And we will link up in the show notes. But if anyone wants to check out what you're working on, it sounds like sivers.org is the place to go.
Yep.
Awesome.
That's it.
Thanks again, my friend. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. See ya.
All right, super friends. That's it for this week's episode. We hope you really, really enjoyed it and learn a ton of applicable stuff that can help you go out there and overcome the impossible. If so, please do us a favor and leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or however you found this podcast. In addition to that, we are always looking for great guest posts on the blog or awesome guests right here on the podcast. So if you know somebody or you are somebody or you have thought of somebody who would be a great fit for the show or for our blog, please reach out to us either on Twitter or by email. Our email is info@becomingasuperhuman.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Becoming Superhuman podcast. For more great skills and strategies, or for links to any of the resources mentioned in this episode, visit www.becomingasuperhuman.com/podcast. We'll see you next time.